Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Peebo Bryson. Bryson is currently working on a memoir and announced in 2025 the upcoming album Grace, which was produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. That, along with his memoir, will see the light of day in 2026 as he continues his Golden Touch tour, a celebration of his 50 years as a recording artist. While we could have discussed many elements of his recording career, Bryson was free with his thoughts, offering observations about his life, opinions on celebrity, and the current social and political climate of both the world and the United States. That and much more from Peebo Bryson on Into Music coming up now. Where's home for you these days?
Atlanta.
Okay, wonderful.
It has been since 1971.
So you've seen the city really change.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would go on trips sometimes to come back from like Japan or someplace. I've been gone for a month or so, and not know my way around. I say, what is this? That's Spaghetti Junction. What? Spaghetti? Who? When did it go up? sometimes you do. I like watching progress, but sometimes Atlanta moves a bit fast.
Yeah.
And then it moves. Now it's moving at a snail's pace because, I mean, I'm on the way to the airport and I see, 30 guys standing around watching a hole. I mean, so you're getting paid to stand here and watch this hole. I don't get it. I mean, when you could be actually in the hole shoring up our city's infrastructure, it's not like we don't need it. You call yourself an engineer, really? You're going to washing a hole? I don't get it. Jed, there are many things I don't get. I'm in my book of essays, I just wrote a piece about my ridiculous list. My ridiculous list of things I wake up to every day. It's like, the phenomenon that occurred to me is people don't wake up to the same reality as me, right? Yeah, I mean, and Jeff, why is that so easy for people to forget and overlook? Can you explain that to me? I mean, what happened to us? Remember when we actually would hold ourselves accountable for knowing what was going on in somebody else's life.
Yeah.
That's who we used to be. Based on individual choice, individual moral compass, because for God crying out loud, we had one. A moral compass.
Right? Yeah, I always say, I was foolish because for the longest time I operated with the understanding that when I walked out the front door, everybody I was going to greet, they were just going to recognize that we were all good people.
Stop it. You're making me nostalgic. Come on, Jed.
I was like, how was I so naive, right?
My son's tutor's husband, he only comes with her because we sit out on the deck while my kid's being tutored and have these conversations. And I'm like, I'm looking at him, I'm going, so where do all the dark, handsome features come from? He said, huh? I said, what's your story? There's something in there. You're a little bit too even. And how is it that you live in the same political, social, and religious environment as I do, and you're not screwed up yet, and you haven't gone down all the many rabbit holes that are available to you? How is that possible? So he laughs and he looks at me and says, "Well, okay, my dad's a Turk and my mom's Jewish." I said, "All right, that explains it all. I got it." I said, "Hey, Dad, never mind. We're you and me boys right here." So we sit out. He's extremely bright, and I like talking to clever people who are, I don't care how esoteric the conversation goes, they don't get lost. And it's like, it's like you grew up in that environment with that kind of religious tension. And yet he's extremely spiritual. I mean, how's that even possible? Well, I know how it's possible. I'm black and I'm still spiritual. After all the persecution, and I don't have to crank my car for it to happen. I don't have to go anywhere. But when I do walk out that door, I know exactly what's waiting for me. I would have been content, Jed, with just making me invisible like before. Right? But you made a monster out of me. Seriously, I find myself asking the same question that Frankenstein asked of his maker. I said, "Who's the monster here? And why does that monster look like me?" I'm like, dude, I'm a made-up thing. And then you say, "Oh, this is how you identify this monster, this color right here." So people do it at a glance. So people that move here, they feel it incumbent upon them to take this mantle up, man, because it makes them more American with these people that they now live with. And you need to question my intelligence or ability to function in a society like this one. That makes you feel more American. Beating up on me or me using me as a chew toy is kind of like a part and parcel to the American dream now. And come on, this is terrible. I can't believe how bad it gets, it's gotten, and I can't believe how many people don't get it. I mean, I'm sitting out on my deck talking to my tutor's husband, and he said, "My circumstances growing up were difficult, but nothing like yours." He said, "I'll take my lot of yours every time." Yeah. Chet, I grew up in the 50s in the South, where they still had signs that said, "No niggers, no Jews, and no dogs." That's where I grew up. My mother and I, my mother worked in all these houses. And one of the houses that she worked in was on a parallel street to ours. Miss Sarah Kappen, a really nice lady, she cooked and served when we worked there, cooked and served breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Made me learn a Hebrew prayer. It kept a kosher house and made me learn a Hebrew prayer. But and I, that's good for me. I was happy to learn it, right? I was happy. So she's doing the same work that she's paying my mother to do right beside her. And she's trying to coax me into going outside and playing. "You're gonna pay me to go out to come and go out in your yard and play." Then I realized the little boy didn't have anybody. Neither did Sarah.
Oh, yeah.
So we weren't really there to work. It was the guys. The gifts of, how about that? That's how I grew up. I've probably been to shul more than anybody I know. You just grow up in these odd environments, and when you do, and when you grow up in these odd environments in the South, it's a different impact. It stays with you always. It becomes a part of the fabric of who you are and what America is, and it's something that you always know is there. You don't always see it, but you know it's there. What were we doing? What made us start talking about this anyway?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we just started, but I'm glad because I wanted to talk about, like, you have plans for a new record and a book and everything. And I wondered if all of this stuff that's going on today, if this is maybe spilling over into the music or spilling over into what you're writing.
It has to. You can't. I can't go silent. But there's only so much that you can say because to go, truth is a very dangerous thing these days, and it's a volatile commodity, at best, and you don't want to putz around with it too much, because when you do, you may say something that strikes a nerve on someone or strikes a fear in someone. And they may think you know more than you do, because you are a person who's aware. And I can't be in this business since I was 14 years old and not be aware of how it works, or who does what and all that. And the circles I move in, people talk. You hear things, and or you see things, or all of the above. So my perspective is going to be a little bit different, but it's not going to be intuitive as much as it is informative, because just proximity. Although I was adorable back in those days, and nobody's ever, I was like, what? I mean, I may have lost my allure at this point, but I don't think so. I think it's, if you have obvious weaknesses, then they will be exploited, and randomly and often, because it is a weakness that someone sees. Whereas if you don't have those chinks in your armor and you are sure of who you are, what you are, and all that, people don't approach me. Nobody's ever, they don't approach me like that now, but there's nobody on this planet that believes, especially in this society, that believes that nothing, that anything can be bought. I mean, so I didn't say I wasn't offered money. I'm not saying that yet. And sometimes the offers are subtle. You have to read between the lines, and then you have to you take the parameters and you play them out in different scenarios, and you examine the data of that result and decide whether you want to be a part of that or something, or you want to make yourself vulnerable, because you're not vulnerable in this way. And then you got these recruiters, or people that you would probably, people that you have admired for quite a bit, and you find out that they're not that admirable because they're recruiting because they're. It's like when the hair on the back of my neck stands up when Hugh Hefner comes across the room and says, "Hey, people, how you doing, man? You coming up to the house?" And I'm like, first of all, how you know me, and why are you inviting me to your house? We've never been formally introduced. Why you get to call me by my first name? I mean, there's all that, So I said, well, hello, Mr. Hefner. I'm referring him to in the way that Emily Post says I'm supposed to, because we have not been formally introduced, and I'm reminding him subtly that you're breaking protocol here, and don't you have manners? I do. Respect the fact that I have manners, and I adhere to them, even if you don't. I would have done the same. I would have extended the same courtesy to you. And as my host, if you could not extend me that much civility in a public meeting, then I won't have any hope for for you as a host, and the level of your civility in your home. So the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I'm not going, but I'm not going to say it's rude to say that to him. So I'm going to say, you're going home now? And he says, oh, in about 30, 40 minutes. I said, oh, give me an hour and a half to see you up there. Jed, if my immortal soul depended on it, I could not tell you where the Playboy Mansion is. I've never been. I don't know where it is. I've never been. I couldn't tell you how to get there. If St. Peter needed that for me to get in, I'm done. I'm hellbound. I may be hellbound anyway, but I'm trying not to. I'm trying not to be. So I just look at him as somebody who's gathering intel, and that's, yeah, I certainly don't believe that you're keeping up that tremendous lifestyle with that crappy magazine. I'm not buying that one. And I don't, and that's not a judgment. And because here's the thing I understand about myself, and I've understood this about me since I was 14. A piece of information I picked up in a little 89-page book that was published in 1923. It said that the highest that's in and the best person we know is in me also. And the lowest that's in the lowest of us is also in me. So we were put on this good earth in an equitable plan, favorite nations plan, if you want to put it, and on an equitable playing field. So that I don't get to judge you, you don't get to judge me, because we're both capable of the same things. The worst is in you is in me, and the best is in me is in you. There's no need to judge each other or assess each other. There's no reason for it. Now, I can point out a danger, and that is just being a good human being to point out that's dangerous right there. Don't do that. I wouldn't go that way. The lure for me would be somebody saying, "Would you like to make this kind of money every year? Every quarter you make something like that check says right there." Well, you can get used to that kind of stuff. The question is, what do you have to do for it? And when somebody tells you, "Oh, okay, n nothing beyond firing your black manager and hiring the manager I want you to have, and giving him 20 more points than you now give your current manager, but you'll get in compensation for that, you'll get one of these every quarter," until a couple of years later, when I'm good and accustomed to having that annual income be what it is, and enjoying my lifestyle that I have with it, and that's when they say, "Oh, you want to continue that lifestyle? Or would you like to? Well, if you want to continue, then we're going to have to make some amendments to this to the original agreement." That's the moment that you don't want. And that's the moment that you set yourself up for, the moment you take any compensation, whatever its currency, for your identity and your personal integrity, your soul, as it were. It's my take on it.
I mean, it's interesting today, right? Like, I hear young people say, "Oh, I want to be famous." And
There's no such thing as that anymore. Don't they know that? Why don't they understand that fame is dead? There's no such celebrity's dead. Dead in the water, man. They just don't know it.
it's sort of that thing that you're talking about, which is like, wouldn't it be better to just be good at what you do
Get
and have your soul, you know?
out of here. Yeah, wouldn't that be better? I had this argument with my mom before I went before I re-signed with Capitol Records. She said, "Be careful, don't let anybody steal your thunder." I said, "If anybody's talented enough to steal my thunder, more power to them." She said, "Yeah." I said, "It's not about somebody stealing your thunder, Mom. It's more about the veracity and the level of your talent." And she said, "Nah." I said, "Well, you only know this business vicariously through me. You're just that's it." She said, "Yeah, but sometimes it's not about the talent. Sometimes it's just about how you look." And I said, "What? How you look versus talent?" I said, "That's got nothing to do with it." We got into this voracious argument about talent versus perception. I was like, okay. I left it. I just couldn't. I couldn't anymore. So we were out there, and we my manager negotiated the re-up contract, and they with no opposition. They weren't opposing anything, but they weren't moving all that fast to cut that cashier's check either. So I was like, so we were waiting around out there. We were fumbling around and sitting on our thumbs out there in L.A. for quite a while there. And so they had this thing. I don't do parties. That's the other thing. Sorry. That's kept me safe too. So I don't care. I don't do strip clubs. I don't do parties. I'm just me. It's just my thing. I don't do drugs either. So I mean, I don't fit really in that circle. So if you don't do any of those things, if that's not your thing, then you're the odd man. You're the odd person now. And I don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. So they're having this thing at Universal, and we get up there, and no, none of the Capitol execs are dodging us or anything like that. And I'm going, what's the deal? So I'm about 30 feet away from the main exec, and he says to my manager, "Where's Peebo?" And David looks around and goes, "There he is over there." He said, "Oh," so he comes walking over to me. I think he's just being cordial. He gives me like. I felt like he gives me the up and down with the eyes that I thought I should have been wearing a short dress and smoking a cigarette standing on a corner somewhere. The way he was looking at me, I was like, he looked me up and down and walked around me. I was like, what's he doing? Reaches in his jacket pocket, pulls out the cashier's check that he's been carrying around all week. He wasn't going to give it to my manager until he saw me. You know what I did? I immediately jumped on my phone and called my mother and apologized. You were absolutely right. It didn't have anything to do with what I thought. I was wrong. Dead wrong. It was about how I looked in that moment to him. I can't tell you how much that realization diminished my. My self-perception. I shouldn't have allowed it to, and it didn't in the way that you think. It diminished my self-perception in the way I thought of myself in terms of how I assessed my personal worth. I had to reassess that. I need to come up with a different equation now because I'm required to. I mean, because my mother was right, I had to, and I did. It didn't take me long. I'm a clever guy. It didn't take me long, but I had to do it. And the fact that I had to make an adjustment like that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, should I say? I've been in a few situations where I got rubbed the wrong way and said some things that I really shouldn't have said. Christmas in Washington. If Julie Andrews calls you up and says, "You want to do Christmas in Washington?" And you say, "Yeah, every Christmas." Right? That's what you say. Who else is going to be there? And Neil Diamond's going to be there too? Oh, yeah. Count me in. So we do Christmas in Washington, and Neil Diamond comes up to me and says, "You know, the president can pardon anybody this time." I said, "Yeah." So it was Mr. President Bush Sr. going out. And I said, "Yeah, no." He said, "Let's go down there. Let's go ask him to pardon Mike Tyson." I said, "Ah." I said, "I may not be the one that needs to approach the president with that one. How about you approach him with it, and I stand by to jump in and amen at any time?" And he said, "Oh, okay. If he's the least bit amenable to it, if he's thinking about it, I'm all over it." And he goes in. I don't know if he did it or not, but he didn't come back and get me. So it must have not worked out all that well. So I'm just assuming it didn't. So Jed, press secretary comes to my dressing room, knocks on the door, and says, "Mr. Bryson, photo op with the president." And I said, "Well, these things only last about 10, 15 minutes. Yeah, I'll wait it out and sneak out of here and it'll be fine. Nobody will be offended." 20 minutes later, another knock on the door. Press secretary again said, "Mr. Bryson, photo op with the president." I said, "Oh, okay, thank you, thank you." I said, 10 more minutes max. 20 minutes later, he comes back again. This time, I open the door. He says nothing. And he's looking at his fingernails. And suddenly, a SWAT team bursts through my dressing room door with drug-sniffing dogs. At your face, man. So I'm thinking, oh Lord, please don't drop anything. Don't plant anything. I'm sorry. Press secretary still hasn't said anything, and neither have the SWAT team. The SWAT team said nothing to me. They're just sniffing through my stuff. He's looking at his fingernails, and he looks at me. This time, he's not plaintive at all. He said, "Mr. Bryson, photo op with the president." I looked at him, and I said, "I'll be right down." So I get down there, and I'm standing between the president and his wife. And this is when I was about to find, I didn't know it at the time, but I was about to find out who was truly in charge all that time, all those 4 years. The devil got in me, and the little thing on my shoulder said, "They pushed you around. They forced your hand, dot, dot, dot. You don't have to take that, dot, 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 dot. Let them know who you are, dot, 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 dot. Stand up for yourself," all of that. So I said, "Well, there's one good thing about this iconic moment that I can take away from this." And she said, "Well, what would that be?" I said, "We'll never have to meet like this again." And the next thing I know, I felt this pain in my kidney, and I was kind of down on one knee. And it was a voice above me, a female voice above me, that said, "Stand up straight and act right." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She dropped me. I'm just saying, I knew who was in charge when I got dropped right then and there. And she was, that's everybody's mom and everybody's grandmother. That was who she was in that moment. And I responded just like I would respond to everybody's mom and everybody's grandmother. "Yes, ma'am." I said, and I pulled them both in closer. I just, it was a kick in the head, and I was straight after that. I was good. I was good. I'm just saying, my reality is going to be different from yours. It's just a little bit. I don't tell that story often. I look at the picture from time to time, and I go, "Oh, yeah, I remember that." But that's what I remember about it. Not that I took a photograph with them. I remember how taking the photograph came to be. Which I didn't mind, by the way. And as a president, I quite liked him. You want to know why?
No.
I liked him because when I was traveling around the globe, he made me feel safe, like people wouldn't just take advantage of me. That made me think that people would, no, let's leave him be. He's American, he's Black American, but let's just leave him. Let's just leave him. He made me feel safe in ways that I don't feel safe now. There are certain places I won't travel to, because I don't want to. I don't trust them, and I don't trust us to keep me safe. It's just me. I wish I could, but I don't.
Well, I mean, I'm curious because all these things that you've experienced and everything, and yet you have this sense of humor.
It's
Just kind of,
palpable, isn't it?
yeah.
It's that you cannot. How one of the book of essays is called "Balancing the Life on the Razor's Edge," and I don't have to tell you who William Somerset Maugham was. I mean, of human bondage and all that, but he wrote "Razor's Edge" as well. Actually, Bill Murray's best work ever. Not arguably, it's just his best work. And it's you can call Lost in Translation a kind of a drama, but not like The Razor's Edge. Razor's Edge was something totally different, and he made you believe in Larry Darrow when when he decided to do something totally different from everybody else, when he taking that spiritual path to the higher enlightenment and human ethics is that's not what you go to college for, because they should have actually college should have beaten all of that out of it. Right? First thing they tell you is that, that spirituality on that level is just metaphoric anyway. The Bible's not metaphoric. The Talmud, the Quran, it's just a story. And why did they need for you not to believe in that, to have a belief system that, because they're not prominent in it. If they're not the protagonist in whatever the story is, whatever it is your life choices are, if they're not the main protagonist, then, and if they can't sell it or claim credit for it, or if it's unaccountable success, then they can't give it to you. You can't have that, because they don't have anything at all to do with it. I was. When you think of life as in reality, in real time, like it is, you better laugh or you're going to be crying. If and it also comes from knowing who you are and what you are. But that requires a lot of research and a lot of soul searching. That means that you have got to face the asshole in you at some point early on in your life and actually deal with it. Denial won't get it done. Denial is just a band-aid that's going to wear off, and the band-aid is not even waterproof. The first shower is gone. And so, I mean, so it's you. You have to look at yourself as you are, fix what's wrong with you as much as you possibly can. But we are all going to have to learn to live and to somehow learn to coexist with the opposite of what we are and what we want to be. Because there are two feral beasts in every human being fighting for dominance 24/7. And my folks are, my Indian heritage tells me that these two feral beasts go at it 24/7, 365 days a year, and the question is which one wins. And the answer to that question, from the Indian's perspective, American Indian's perspective, and my grandmother, was whichever one you feed the most. So if I'm feeding the other guy, the other part, the good parts, the prime pieces of the meal. Of the meal or from of my daily bread, then I can keep this. This is not a this this humor thing is not a facade. It's the reality to me is that things like bigotry, racism, hatred requires so much energy. I don't have it to waste, and I don't want to waste what energy I have on something so frivolous and futile. I refuse to do it. So it's, I don't take it seriously, because it's not a serious thing to take. I mean, you hate me for what reason? You don't know me. So you know the monster that they created of me, but that's an image. It's not a reality. And racism is basic in this country is basically a rumor that keeps getting told over and over and over again. And every time it's told, it's like a snowball rolling down the side of a snow-covered hill that's just growing. It just grows exponentially because it's told so often. It's like every other story. It's like me being a monster. It's a scary story that's told over and over and over again. It's like if I'm a have-mat guy or a have-at guy and I come and fix your vacuum system, and you look at me and go, "Are you sure you have the right house? Or shouldn't they send somebody else out here to help you?" It's like some people talk to me sometimes like I'm hard of hearing. It's like it's a rumor. Well, like not unlike the old ones. What were the old ones? I had a tale that came out 12 o'clock at night. There was some kind of physical metamorphosis that was going to take place. I mean, truly, I'm making somebody believe that I'm some kind of monster. Oh, and the other one, oh, I'm always looking in the dark, ready to pounce on any female that doesn't look like me, and to steal her virtue and her innocence, to desecrate both. That's my sole purpose in life. That's all I think about. It's what's on my mind all day, every day. Wouldn't that be comical to you? I mean, as dystopian as it is, it's still comical, isn't it? It's like it's so ridiculous. It's comical. And but the thing is that I find it's funny is how many people believe it. They actually buy into it. And it's like, and I'm waiting on the ultimate irony to take place. And you know what the ultimate irony would be for me? If Atlas 31 showed up and a bunch of 10-foot brothers got actually got up and said, "Yeah, I have all the technology you need. We're gonna end all wars and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you've been waiting on me this whole time. I'm tired of watching you guys struggle with it, so we came to save everybody." That would be the height of irony for me. But the irony is, it wouldn't be the first time it happened. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that's happened. If you want to go back to the Industrial Revolution, the first time it happened. So, I don't know if I would could ever stop laughing. I don't know that I could. I probably could someday, but I mean.
Well, and I would have to think too, like when you've had those experiences, but then like, and I mean, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that this happened in your career where suddenly you're surrounded by yes people.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, oh, yesterday people thought that I was lower than dirt, and today you want to make me a king.
You're talking to a guy who had zero to recommend me. I was just what people indulgently refer to as a dreamer. And that as a kindness for someone who walks around with their head in the clouds all the time and who's never going to amount to anything. That's what it really means. Just metaphorically, and you know that. We all know what it means. He's a little bit touched in the head. He thinks he's going to be. I did not own a car until I signed my first record deal. Didn't own a car. Not even a hoopty, not a jalopy or. Now, I never owned a car. So I can't, you can't imagine how difficult it was to date and have some kind of integrity about, I'm showing up like this love, Mr. Lover Man on the bus, on the city bus. This is not Brooklyn or, this is not Flatbush or Manhattan, where that's cool. You showed up on a train, that was nothing. You in Manhattan or on Flatbush, you're gonna be at some point you're gonna be out on the sidewalk with some of everybody. That's just the way that is. Greenville, South Carolina is not that kind of urban sophisticated. So it's a cool place. I didn't say that. I didn't say that it wasn't. It's just not a New York or not a Flatbush place, not a Jersey place. So it's not having anything to recommend yourself, and then suddenly finding yourself in a position where I'm in my bedroom, I'm on my knees, I'm praying to God, and I'm basically establishing a new covenant between myself and God. Not unlike Abraham, but unlike Abraham, I knew what a covenant was. He did. because he had never had to. He'd heard of them, but he didn't know the functionality of it. He didn't, and the procedure he didn't know. So it's in that moment that I'm this. What I'm offering back to God is not just my loyalty, but my perspective on what will always be more important to me than success. You have to make those distinctions early on. And these things about life will always mean more to me than success will mean to me. And I kept my portion of the covenant. And there, another thing I don't do is I don't do evil for the sake of evil. It's not my thing. So I made a covenant that of things I felt like I could actually do to give myself an actual shot at it. And at some point, when you keep your when you know you've kept your word to God, it's in terms of your covenant that's personal. Eventually, you're gonna get what you prayed for. It's sometimes the answer is actually yes, and you don't know that until you make that covenant in yourself. Now, my girlfriend at the time did not know anything about any of this, and so when I woke up emotional about it's already done, it's a done deal, it's already happened. I don't. It's you have no idea. I've been waiting on this for a long time. I worked hard for it. She called Georgia Baptist and Atlanta. That's the guys with the straight jackets. They come. She thought I was having a psychotic episode, right? Instead of a spiritual epiphany, she thought I was having a psychotic break. I was like, no, and I tried to get her to understand. I said, no, please don't call them. You don't need to call them. It's quite all right. I'm quite fine. And just, I was as good as signed with Capitol Records within 10 days. And I knew no one at Capitol Records that was actually using them as leverage to sign my new contract that I'd written out for the Bang Records that I was already with. I did not know one executive at Capitol Records, not one. I could, and so finally, Joel Katz says, "Exactly who at Capitol are you talking to?" I know them pretty well. I said, and I was like, Jade, I would have won the Oscar. I said, as if I would tell you so you could subvert my efforts. Oh, man, that was good. Come on. That's not a better comeback to that one right there, is it? Not a safer one, more efficient. That was, it was a lot of, wasn't a lot of words to get caught up in, trapped in. It was precise and short and, oh, it was perfect. Somebody came in who was manning the phones. That wasn't her job, but she would help out every now and then if the call volume was like high up or something. So she knocks on the door and says, "I'm sorry to interrupt, but people, they have a call from a Larkin Arnold from Capitol Records." Now this is where I would have won the Oscar. I turned around and surveyed the room very slowly. I looked at everybody in the eye. I said, "Guys, I've been telling you over and over and over and over again. I can't run any further. I can't stall any further. I've got to take this. You guys talk among yourselves. But one way or another, when I come back, it's a yay or nay. I'm signing or I'm gone. I don't even know what this guy wants. I don't know this Larkin. I don't even know what he wants." It turns out that my covenant with God is really coming into fruition. He actually wants to sign me. So you sit there going, it can't be. And when he says it to me, I said, "Listen, I just want to get this guy off the phone and get back and go back and sign my contract because I got them exactly where I want them, right?" He says, actually, we would. Can you hold off signing for a few days and see if we, and let us try to talk you into coming with us? I said, seriously? He didn't know for the longest that I was lying about them. He didn't know. He found out later on. Because originally in my career, I was originally, the music was not what you would think. The music was, I was the original Darius Rucker. Believe it or not, I was a black rocker. I mean, I was, that's what I was. And that I was cool with that because I wanted to just be different from everybody else. But then I started begging them to try to do my own work and let me write, let me produce, let me, and talking somebody into giving you a $500,000 budget to do something that you've never proven that you could do is not an easy ask. And finally, I did talk them into it because there were too many things like Gamble and Huff was just there. They were a little bit too testy and full of themselves because everything they were touching was turning to gold and platinum and beyond, right? And it was the level of their success was ridiculous. They had the most ridiculous producers and songwriters, Tom Bell, Linda Creed. Get out of here. They're better songwriters someplace. No, better producers anywhere. When I heard Make Up to Break Up the first time, I thought I'd lose my mind. They were like, Leon's asking me stupid questions like, you ever done any recording before? Okay. All right. That's enough with this guy, right? Quincy said, still getting over the surgery from the brain surgery thing. I'm not feeling in a place where I can physically do it. I mean, it's not my record company. Bang was going all out to try to make it happen for me. They really were. I can't fault them ever for that. I would be forever grateful to them and forever grateful for them to allow that for allowing me to be the third self-contained artist. Stevie, Marvin, next guy was me. I mean, on the nuts, nobody knew it, but I mean, it's not something to talk about. And then I had the great mentor, like the great Paul Davis, who wrote "I Go Crazy" and "65 Love Affair" and all that, "Bride of the Cowboy." And, can I do this, Paul? It might be all right. He's from Meridian, Mississippi, and he just looked at me, and we recorded something. And go, Peabo, your voice just kills me, and I was like. Thank you, Paul. Your voice kills me too. And it's like, because he, and it actually did, because he was a very soulful, honest, in-pitched voice, and he was a Waylon Jennings fanatic, and I didn't have the heart to tell him that he was so much better than Waylon. I probably should have, but he's just better than Waylon to me, and I didn't mind Waylon at all. But I didn't like Waylon like I liked Paul, and just and a finer human being I've never met. Just an even guy. He was always the same person, and that helped me go find me. And if you asked earlier if the new music reflected any of the things that are going on now. It's like, yeah, there's a Bruno Mars-like track that we put together, and it's like, and it's between Bruno Mars and Tower Power. Yeah, it's funky. It's like, but it's the lyric is race, too wide to get around, too high to get over. Gotta be a believer to be a good soldier. Slow down and free your mind if you want to get older. Or you want to spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder. It's like, and then the chorus is, have we seen our better days? Can we turn it around? It's the innocent who pays for what's lost to be found. Is it just a violent phase? Or is it by design or a new sign of the times? While another mother prays that the next child won't be mine. Now, that's the one. That's the line right there. That's the one that scares me the most. It's the one thing that I can't, it's not funny. I can't laugh about it. Or it's like a man who has autonomy over me, who has a gun and a badge, and is set loose on me, is a despotic power that I cannot, I don't have anything for. I have the Constitution, but I don't get to use the Constitution until somebody allows it. I don't have the same autonomy that you do to use the Constitution that protects you. I don't have that. And what if you notice in all these videos you see of policemen abusing their power, the one thing that you see that ticks them off is that you're not doing what they're whatever they're telling you to do. It doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be legal. You're just not minding them, like you're not allowing them to rule over you in some despotic way that is absolutely ridiculous. It's and illegal. They don't care about that. You shut up. Are you talking back to me? Well, who are you, my mother? No, you're not. I can't speak. I mean, come on, man, seriously? You can't tell grown men not to talk, and you can't don't put your hands in your pocket. Don't do this. Why not? What did I do? I don't have to tell you. Why not? I don't have to give you my name and my badge. I don't. Why not? When my wife, who's British, moved to this country with me, I said, no, when we got ready to get married, I said, no, there's one deal breaker we have. Never call the police to our house for any reason. I don't care if we're attacked by aliens. I don't care if somebody's burning a cross in the yard. I don't care what. Don't ever call the police because it's not going to turn out well for me. There's no scenario where that's going to turn out well for me, where that's safe for me. Policemen going to people's houses, knocking on doors at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, telling the other guy to come out of there. I've been in a situation here in Atlanta once, where long ago, where I was about to get my own apartment, I believe, or was about to move in with my first roommate, one of the two. But I was staying at this hotel, and it had this wide spiral staircase, and it had this vending area down there. So I went down there to grab some snacks and some sandwiches and something to drink. And I saw the two policemen down there. I didn't pay them any mind. And I went back upstairs, and so I'm fumbling around with my key at my door, trying to put my stuff, some of it down, so I can get in. And when the two policemen are suddenly behind me, and one of them says, I'm watching him. He's watching me so closely. So I open the door, I unlock the door, and he says, I'll tell the other guy to come out. I'm like, excuse me? What other guy? Tell the other person in that room to come out. I said, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. You sure you have the right room? And I said, there's nobody in there. He said, I've asked you twice. I'm telling you now. Tell the other guy to come out of there. I said, if you think that there's another guy in there, then you go in there and you get him. And I pushed the door open and said, you go get him. And the next thing I know, this guy slammed me against the wall. I was like, wait a minute. He grabbed me and snatched me back and slammed me against the wall. And didn't wake. I've never woken a day in my life and thought to myself, I think I'm going to elbow a policeman in the solar plexus today. Not once in my life have I woken and said, that's what I'm going to do. My goal for today. I hit this guy so hard and so perfectly. He folded up like a cheap accordion, and his partner was, and he was down on his knees, and he was trying to get his sidearm out. He wanted to blow me away right then and there, and his partner was crying tears. He said, "In case I kept trying to tell you it wasn't him, it's the wrong. I got kept trying to tell you." And this guy, he's like, "I said, I am so sorry, officer. And his partner was saying, he was crying tears. He said, "Just go in, close the door. Don't open it. Don't open it. If we knock on it, don't open it. Just get in there." He's like, if it wasn't a, if it wasn't a classic good cop, bad cop, in real character, in real time, we wouldn't be having this interview. I can tell you now, that my career would have never happened. It would have been over right then and there. But that's how close you come all of the time. And that's a very real possibility for me. Not for anybody else. It's like it's not unlike Tiger Woods showing up at a golf course. It's like when somebody just says, "Show up, nigger, and you're dead." It's hard to play golf. I'm sorry. That's gonna make me, it would make my butt cheeks a little bit tight over that 15-foot putt to win it. I don't know about you, Jed, but my butt cheeks are gonna be a little bit tight. And he was winning all that stuff then. He was winning all those tournaments with death threats every single time, not just on the phone and left him messages and papers and all that, but yelled out from the crowd sometimes. I mean, yeah, I'm just saying that. And that's a real kind of paranoia because you don't know where the enemy is because there's so many people there you can't really single them out. Not a comfortable feeling. I mean, so we don't know how many how many majors he would have won without that. I'd like to think that it probably inspired him in some ways at some times, but I'm sure it also detracted from his success quite a bit as well. I would imagine, unless he's inhuman. I mean, I again, does it? You can make a statement about something without pissing and moaning about something. I don't like bullies, and if that hasn't come across, then let me just apologize in advance. I don't like bullies. They scare me because they make me lose my compassion. I don't really care what I do to them. I think probably that one of the most dangerous things in this life, and it takes a lot to scare me, but somebody with nothing to lose. Anybody with nothing to lose, it frightens me. Anybody who's elevator doesn't go quite to the top, and they can't get out of their own way.
You've been listening to a conversation with Peabo Bryson. He's set to release a memoir and new album titled Grace, produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis in 2026. His Golden Touch tour continues into the new year. You can learn more about all of his activities at PeaboBryson2.com. That's Peabo Bryson followed by the number 2.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And also want to take a moment to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.